Welcome back to How to Tickle Yourself. I'm your host, Joey of Rockledge, along with my co-host, Duff McDonald. Our guest today, our guest today is Andrew Faust. Andrew is the founder and director for the Center for Bioregional Living and a permaculture teacher, designer, and activist. And what is permaculture, you might ask? It's a system of design that mimics nature to create systems for growing food, taking care of the earth, and those of us who live here. But to be honest, that barely scratches the surface of what it covers. Andrew's been involved in permaculture for many, many years and has taught permaculture design courses and workshops all around the world. He's also an advocate for social and environmental justice and believes that permaculture can play a crucial role in addressing issues such as climate change, food insecurity, and social inequality by promoting sustainable and regenerative practices. I mean, it might all sound very serious, but believe me, it's very ticklish stuff. You'll see. Andrew is known for his dynamic style of teaching and his ability to inspire people to take action and make positive changes in their communities. And that is not just hearsay. I speak from experience. I took Andrew's permaculture course, his design course, online during COVID, and I can say without any exaggeration that it changed my life. It changed how I view the world. For instance, now I have chickens who dominate my life, and our lawn is now a food forest in the making and a garden. I think the only person that's had that much influence on me is, you know, maybe Duff and my mom. So, Andrew, welcome to the show. We're really excited to see you again and have you here.
Oh, an honor, Joey. Thank you. Thanks so much. What a great introduction.
It barely touches it, though.
At the present moment, traveling town to town, the mystery of the motion, right here, right now. Right here, right now. Whoa, whoa, right here, right now.
So after taking your course, Joey was walking around this house throwing the term permaculture around left, right, and center. Why don't we get it from the horse's mouth here? What is permaculture?
Well, it's you know, it has a historic place that is its origin, and then it also has all the things that people associate with it. So, I mean, the term itself, permaculture, has a certain technical agricultural sciences lineage that it harkens back to. So it comes from this idea that really starts in the 1920s in the United States of asking, what does it look like to create a way of farming that is going to solve a lot of problems that they were already experiencing in the way of the Dust Bowl and the unsustainability of industrialized, mechanized agriculture was already showing up that, you know, long ago, as, you know, by the 1920s. And this term, permanent agriculture, is the predated term of permaculture. And it then, the contraction permaculture comes about with David Holmgren and Bill Mollison in Australia in the 70s. And it's much more broad in its scope than simply looking at, although simply is an understatement in reference to agriculture and farming. Certainly, those are the foundation of civilization as we know it. And the foundation of permaculture is looking at how do we redesign the food system. But it's added to it, the energy system. Really, the synopsis is all of the things that it takes to support a human settlement are what permaculture design is about. And it's a design process you can apply to any situation or set of circumstances that turns out to be quite useful and quite fruitful when you bring it into play in urban environments, in broader landscape applications, which is where we go with a lot of what we're presenting in our permaculture framework is how do we redesign the whole infrastructure? So it can go, you know, it goes from these nuts and bolts of what does it look like to redesign farming in a way that what they mean by permanent agriculture in the 20s is trees. There's a big focus on tree crops and being in a temperate deciduous forest. You know, the eastern landscape of the United States is of such a nature that looking at what we can do with trees makes a lot of good sense here because they do really well here. So we can get pretty creative about what kind of landscape we're planting out. And that's, again, I think permaculture has a really deep and well-developed history of knowledge and research into is how do we feed people and feed more of the animals with tree crops.
And what was it that led you to permaculture? How did you end up doing this as for your life's work?
You know, it's a process. My main thread into permaculture has been as an educator, as a teacher, looking for pathways to expand people's understanding of what's possible. And, you know, as I became very articulate in what the problems were by the mid-90s, teaching at a K-12 high school and creating classes around educating high school students in what the real inequities and legacies are of our present system and looking for solutions and finding sort of like a hodgepodge of them, like a grab bag of them. And coming across permaculture really was useful as a teacher because it synthesizes a lot of different questions about how to heal, how to correct, how to address the problems of the present system by designing another system that doesn't repeat the mistakes of the present one.
And I mean, nature sort of already has the way a forest work, or it already gives us kind of a, like the structure for what needs to change, right? The way the world likes to work naturally is kind of what we're trying to incorporate and mimic in an ideal world. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And I would say innately mimic it as human beings as part of nature. We are part of nature. So when we trust ourselves more and use more of our patience and observation to teach us what makes good sense to be moving forward with in the world, then, you know, things are more in balance. And it's when we kind of don't look to ourselves, but look to things outside of ourselves to be what it is that we're, you know, developing our understanding from. And certainly,
right, we look to the numbers.
Yeah. And certainly in permaculture itself as a modality, as has regenerative and agroforestry, I think have one of their weaknesses right now is that they're overly market driven in their model of what is the viable kind of way to see them move forward. I have certainly more to share about that. But I think that, you know, I think it's important to understand that it is true we need to be planting out more trees, but as to what those trees are and where they are, it's actually an important nuance to the conversation out there.
So we just had those crazy floods in New York City.
Yeah.
Last week.
Yeah.
Did permaculture have something to say about that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the short and sweet answer for all human beings, but especially city dwellers, for those of us living in urban landscapes, you know, we need to green up the city, green infrastructure. There's already a lot of understanding about how to mitigate, alleviate, to use the technical language, how to improve stormwater problems that happen in huge rain events like 7 inches and however short amount of time that was. You know, when you look at the urban environment with permaculture viewpoints, you want to start from the top of the landscape and work your way down. So extensive green roofs, tax incentivizing extensive green roofs, which are partially already on the books in New York City. Part of why New York City is ahead of the curve in comparison to, let's say, Philadelphia, why Chicago's even more ahead than New York City is because of tax incentivization for green infrastructure. Hmm. So green infrastructure is like the planning language for what a permaculture first step is in the city. because that's, it helps to curb urban heat island effect. It helps to address stormwater issues. Simply put, it's green roofs, more permeable surfaces, deeper street tree pits, bigger rain tanks. I mean, tens of thousands of gallon rain tanks, various ways to basically either get that water to soak in somewhere before it ends up low in the landscape, like filling up subway tunnels. And, you know, that's all about permeable surface, impervious surface. And so the creative design challenge in New York City and in any densely urbanized environment is, where can we creatively create a deeper spot for that water to soak in and plant something there?
Wow.
So that's our design challenge, our design opportunity is to, in effect, really do a block-by-block analysis of where can we create more green space, anywhere and everywhere that you can, as first opportunity, and then to create infiltration zones within those green spaces.
What do you mean by an infiltration zone?
Rain gardens and retention ponds and water features that dry up after the end of a rainstorm.
And is that kind of thing happening in New York City now? Are they looking to do that?
Not as much as hardscaping solutions. And, you know, they've done a lot of crazy stuff along the East River where they were clear cutting a bunch of forests to put in a park. I mean, it's a multi-headed hydra, the city, it's bureaucracy. You know, it's like it's got parts of it that are onto the right thing and then parts of it that are not.
So from setting aside your work as a teacher,
yeah.
Which I can testify that Joey was being very sincere. You've changed her world. Mm-hmm. In a professional capacity,
yeah.
Who is calling you and saying, "Help me do this thing"?
Well, the most common thing that I'm hired to do as a consultant is this service I offer called property analysis, where people find my website online and they fill out a form and they tell me that they want me to give them some advice about land. And so what I do is I then look at the address, look at what they want advice about, look at how many acres it is, and then I write them back, give them a price, and describe what it is that I'll help them figure out about their property when I walk it. And that often then leads to people, if they're not too far away, asking me to implement a lot of the things that I say suggest about their property after walking it. Now, I also do this thing that people hire me to do that I enjoy doing. The thing that's interesting about permaculture as a business enterprise, I think it's important to say, is that you're in a sense creating a market or creating a client base that in a kind of coming in the door doesn't even know exactly what they want to buy. So it's a very unique selling operation where they're like, "I've heard about this thing. I know it's kind of about this. Do you do that?" And then I'm writing back, "Yeah, I do that. Plus all this other stuff." We build natural buildings for clients, right?
That's what I wanted to ask about too.
That's an example. That's a perfect segue, because that's an example of what I'm referring to as a tangible, you know. We've built 5 straw bale houses in the area. And when I say we, I mean a graduate of my permaculture class, Jeff Gagnon, has a company called Rondout Natural Builders. You can find them on Instagram under that. All run word. Rondout is RONDOUT. It's named River around here, Rondout Natural Builders.
We live not too far from there.
Yeah. And they're a collective, and he's a graduate of ours and studied with me in New York 10 years ago and already was a skilled contractor and had some building experience. Anyway, he's now built 5 houses for clients that all decided to have built a style of construction that we found through the design process made sense for the client. In other words, I want to clarify, we have built what are called straw bale houses, but it's not because we come in saying, "You should have a straw bale house." What we're doing is we're working with people and talking about their goals for what they want, and then suggesting from our repertoire of what are natural materials that could work to fit what the site accommodates, it is made sense that we built these five straw bale houses. And the last house that we built is hempcrete, that is an innovative material that in order to build with it, some of the hemp herd, which is used in the, when you make hempcrete, you combine hemp, the ground up center of the stem of industrial hemp, hemp for cloth. And the stem of it is so big that you grind it up in what's called a decordator, something like this. And it takes the pith of it and you combine it with lime, and then you can just fill a wall cavity with it, and it has good R value and good, wow. So it's a new insulation. It's very antimicrobial, antifungal, and natural, hypoallergenic.
And so could you talk a little bit, just we're talking about natural building. Can you talk about some of like why someone would want to build naturally versus like a conventional sort of building? Like what are some of the, yeah, just for our listeners and me.
You know, for me, part of natural building is part of what I cut my teeth on when I decided, okay, I'd gone to a bunch of organic farms and been doing reforestation projects for the town and seen a lot of different biodynamic farms. I was like, well, there's not that. All these things that I learned about in my permaculture class had to do with natural building. A lot of them did. There isn't that much of it. This is a very niche kind of subculture. That then I decided in 1999, I'm going to go buy 17 acres and build what I call my permaculture PhD project with, and it included a off-grid straw bale home at the time because I wanted to explore how to build in a cold climate with natural materials. It's a post and beam frame with straw bale. So this lineage of exploring natural building is part of why we're in that trade up here, because I cut my teeth on that in a very remote site to learn things about, well, how much can you do with a chainsaw and a generator and some friends and a pickup truck in a remote place with no drywall, with no Tyvek, with no plywood, and all just rough cut lumber. And, you know, traditional fasteners, still, you know, nails and timber locks and that kind of stuff, but not using a lot of like hangers and kiln dried lumber and stick framing. So learning these traditional crafts is part of permaculture processes that enable us to build houses then that are very high quality houses for a cost competitive price. You know, and the thing I think that's important to understand for listeners who are interested in this type of construction, the question is less, why would somebody want it? It's more, how are they going to go about finding this type of option? Because sadly, it's a very, it's not easy to find.
Right.
It's not very available. And so you're in a category where if you're a DIY individual, if you're willing to do it yourself, or that's who you'll see does a lot of natural building, say cob or straw bale or rammed earth or adobe or these more, because they're labor intensive and there's a learning curve with them. So what our crew has figured out is how to do things in a way that fits what the building departments and what these, you know, how to use these really nice high quality artisanal materials. Everything's earthen plasters and lime washed plasters for interior finishes. Why you would want it is because it's very superior air quality and performance with no electricity at all being involved in what makes the building envelope keep you warm in the wintertime and cool in the summertime, right? So it's a very comfortable type of building to live in that has a much more just comfortable feel and experience for people.
It's more like the way they did things like 300 years ago. Like a friend of ours just bought a little stone house in Stone Ridge, and it stays very cool in the summertime. And it's, we'll see if it's warmer in the winter,
yeah.
But the walls are 2 feet thick, you know?
Right. It is like that, but with much higher R value. Because stone has a lot of mass, whereas straw has a lot of airspace. But you do end up with a 18-inch wide wall.
What is R value?
R value is how you measure insulation. So the lower the number is, the less high quality the insulation is. You know, if it's R5, R40. Pretty sure right now, building code in Marbletown in that area would probably be at least R42 in your wall is required. And roofs are starting to go as high as R50 something, which is very high. It used to be that there is barely any code or zoning about that. And I think that's definitely an improvement that building departments have gotten much more stringent about all new construction having to have pretty substantial insulation going on.
I was sitting in the living room of this house like 8 years ago or so during a windy winter storm. And I was working and I was like, I can't possibly be feeling a cold wind right now because I'm inside.
Yeah.
So we have a very low R value.
It is. It's like our house is 100 years old or so, but it seems very thoughtful in the building. You know, yeah. It's like the kitchen and the living room get sun in the morning and it warms them up. But our living room stays very cool throughout the summer.
Yeah.
Like it just seemed like we seem to lose something somewhere during the industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the thoughtfulness, I guess.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if we could shift gears just a tiny bit and talk about biodynamic farming. And what is biodynamic farming for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Biodynamics comes out of Rudolf Steiner's thinking. Steiner, folks may know him from Waldorf education. He's the main thinker behind that pedagogy. And Steiner also wrote, he didn't write. He's a clairvoyant who channels from the astral plane. And so people transcribe, and that's self-avowed. That's what he's on the books as. And Steiner, he gave like 7 lectures in 1924, 28, right around the same time as Tree Crops. That book comes out. And it's those lectures that then biodynamics is based on. But then biodynamics also has a bunch of people in it who add to Steiner's stuff that are important and add substantial material to it. Maria Thun develops the planting calendar. I like the planting calendar because as a gardener, it gives you this fun kind of way to just think about what you're doing in the garden and when. You can kind of drop it if you want to, but what it does is the calendar, should I break it down real briefly?
Sure. Yes, please.
So the calendar, how it works and why I think people would find this an interesting thing to play around with and experience and let it tickle your fancy is breaks a plant into root, fruit, leaf, and flower. And these are based on the astrological signs of earth, air, fire, and water. And then it associates when to plant root crops, which is a crop that you want to harvest the root aspect of, carrots, radishes. It gets funny into technical plant botany when we think about things like onions, which aren't actually a root. They're actually a leaf that continues to get, so you plant onions on. Okay. But anyway, roots are just like what you would think a root crop is, right? And then you have fruit crops, which are things like, you know, peppers and tomatoes. And then you have leaf crops, which are a lot of what we eat, lettuces and cabbages and all of these. And so it breaks down root crop, fruit crop, leaf crop, based on when the sign that's associated with water sign is lined up with a certain phase of the moon and a certain phase of the sun.
That makes perfect sense. I mean, if the moon has an effect on the tide, it's got to have an effect on the water that's in the soil and the plant and all of us.
Yeah. So then there's a lot of things to go on. Biodynamics, there's a whole certification you can take in it here at Chestnut Ridge at the Pfeiffer Center, Pfeiffer, Aaron Fried Pfeiffer. He's one of the people who back in Steiner's day lived a lot longer than him and kept writing about biodynamics. Steiner died in his mid-40s.
So that sounds like biodynamics, the calendar there sounds like something that could be easily observed as being a superior method. Is it an accepted fact?
It is. Yeah. Biodynamics over the years has become more and more substantiated, included in what we might call the sort of more traditional middle of the road organic conferences and events that happen. Now there's more and more operations that are biodynamic, and they receive a lot of respect from the growing community. There's a lot of things about biodynamics that the way I look at it is that even if you can't quantify in a causal way how some of what they're recommending works out, at the end of the day, it's more a result, the quality that it yields is more a result of the heightened level of attention to detail that's involved in. It's like when you're paying that much attention to what you're doing, like it's going to work out better. It's going to work out better.
We don't need to have to know exactly why.
Yeah,
it just is.
It just is.
Right.
Because you're futzing around that much to make sure you're doing it on the right day at the right time with the right plant. You know, it's like that attention to detail alone gives you a better return for your effort with gardening.
I tried that for the first time this year, and I have to say, I don't know if it's just because everything's starting to kind of fall into place and I know a little bit more of what I'm doing, but my garden definitely worked better this year. And I tried to plant on planting days, sow seeds on the days I said to sow seeds.
Yeah.
So I did try to follow along this year, and it definitely has worked out. The garden's been, I think, the best we've had so far.
A project I would want to share about before we wrap up here would be this land trust that we've created recently. It's called a Permaculture Living Lands Trust.
Mm-hmm. What's that?
If I could share a little of that with you all.
Please, yeah.
You might find it interesting. It's sort of nascent in its development. We're 1 year old at this point. It's three of us. It's my colleagues, David Harper and Lisa DePiano. And we've got a federal status for a nonprofit that is the Permaculture Living Lands Trust, with a mission that is focused on really bringing back the commons in a sense of where food comes from being something that is more a universal human right, in the sense that it gets folded into the landscape in a way that everybody has access to it. So food access, food security, and part of how to bring that about is through regional planning for what it looks like to help communities go more food self-reliant within their community. And one of the case studies we've been working on as an example of that full prospectus, I mean, we have a couple near-term projects that are more specific that we've chose to focus on that I want to share with you too. But the broad vision is this vision of watershed planning, which we've done a scale study for the Rondout watershed, doing analysis for what does it look like to grow all the food for all the people in the Rondout watershed.
Wow.
And there's data points that we've started with that are already established by other studies. So we're just lifting their baseline and saying, all right, there's one called a Food Vision for Lower New England, where they studied how much land would it take to grow most of the food for most of the people in six states. They asked 14 million people, it would take 16 million acres. So their number is 1.6 acres per person for an omnivore delight diet, year-round full diet. And so we took that as our baseline. We thought omnivore delight, all the meat and dairy is pastured on marginal lands, grass-fed, humanely raised. Meat still average consumption that's lower than the typical US, but not pure vegetarian diet, right? So thought out to get to this number, 1.6 acres per person, omnivores to love. So you do the numbers for the Rondout, it's about 700,000 acres between Kingston and say Wurtsboro, Ellenville area, which is the Rondout watershed. It's about 92,000 people. Total acreage is 720,000 acres of land. The amount we'd have to turn into food production is just 120,000 acres out of 700,000 some acres.
Wow.
And you could grow full diet year-round food supply for that entire population. And so it's interesting, as it turns out, when we do numbers like this, because we're in this temperate climate where it's actually a really easy place to go food independent here and to stop all this nonsense of importing. You know, and I often, when I bring this up, I'll tell you, and just to speak to this potential, like how do we shoot it down mind that we've all been pre-programmed with around ideas like this. The classic one people will say to me is, and so let me just, you know, diffuse it, is, well, what about bananas? What about, what about oil? What about oranges, right? I'm like, okay, look, I am not saying we're going to try to tell people not to eat bananas and avocados. What I'm saying is we could grow all the potatoes. We could grow 70% of the potatoes. We could grow 70, 80% of the onions. Let's start. All I'm talking about is stuff that's easy to grow right here. Let's start with that, right? Let's not get confused about what it means to be regionally food, more regionally food self-reliant, right? It's like right now, the numbers are estimated, again, by a number of studies, that typical community in the United States, 90% of what they eat is not from anywhere close to where they live. 90% of your average American's diet comes from, you know, 3,000 miles away, 10,000 miles away, the other side of the planet.
Joey, this might have been after she took your course, but Joey told me a while ago about a notion that had never occurred to me that's related to what you just said, which is that you probably want to eat food that thrives locally because it, like you, lives where you are.
Yeah.
So what is there a name for that idea?
Well, I would say that one diet methodology that definitely includes that is macrobiotic.
Okay.
Definitely in the macrobiotic diet, there's a real focus on eating seasonally and eating locally because of the beneficial microbes, because you're getting into your biome. And I'm comfortable with eating bananas and avocados, but it's like, let's have the potatoes be grown right here.
Well, I started after your class. I was like, okay, I want to try to grow all of our food. That's my big goal.
Yeah.
But my first one was, okay, what can I, if I just do our smoothies, what could I grow?
Right.
And instead of bananas, I was like, what about pawpaws?
Oh.
So I planted a bunch of pawpaw trees. They're still little, but we'll see how it goes.
They're a slow grow. They say in nursery business, sleep, creep, and leap. First year you plant a tree, it sleeps. Second year it creeps. Third year it leaps. With pawpaws, I have to say, I think it's more like sleep, sleep, sleep,
sleep. Okay, that makes me feel sleep. Better.
And then leap. It really is. It's almost like 5-6 years before they really start to do what you were hoping they would. Because they have this really long taproot. Anyway, yeah, they take a bit. But worth the patience, for sure. Because once they do get legs, they really take off and start putting out a lot of fruit. Yeah, that's a great choice for a local smoothie alternative, especially the banana alternative because of the custard flavor.
And if somebody is looking to explore permaculture a little further or natural building, where will they find you?
Well, my website has a whole trove of information there I think listeners would enjoy, and it's permaculturenewyork.com. It's all spelled out, permaculturenewyork.com. And you'll see I have a library of videos there that I encourage people to listen to and watch because they're very well put together and well organized for you. A lot of free, quick perspectives and observations about improving our lives, both at a home scale and about ways to improve the city, improve our overall sense of well-being where we're living is the grander vision. And really, you know, I like to say bringing in our allies. You know, we have a myriad of allies that are waiting to be acknowledged and honored and brought into our lives. And those allies are in the form of plants and animals and microbes and gardening the earth more where we are, inevitably has a positive return and feels fulfilling when we're in that recognition that we really have, in a sense, exiled ourselves from a community that wants to come back and be part of our lives. And that community is the community of plants, the community of animals, the community of biodiversity. And in addition to wild plants and animals, there's all the biodiversity of cultivated diversity, all the diversity of the heritage heirloom seeds that we can be saving and all the complex traditional heritage breeds of animals, which there's a myriad of. If we go back to things like responsibly harvesting something as sacred as a tree, really the most ecological way to do that is with horses. And horse logging is hands down the most low impact way to harvest wood. And one of the big travesties of the modern era has been the industrialization of logging, because it's just called the decimation of forests. And as soon as we get more selective about how we relate to wild ecologies like forests and like the ocean, they're really waiting to give us way more than we can possibly consume. They're super abundant ecosystems. They've just been harvested. They've been trashed. And like, as soon as we stop allowing that continue, industrial fishing with trawling, right? Industrial logging, all of a sudden these wild ecologies will rebound in ways that will be really positive and is a positive experience when we do it. You know, when they remove dams, big dams on rivers, they're always very surprised how fast the wild fish start coming back, like right away. So I think that's a big part of what I would leave folks with, is where my optimism lies, is in seeing how resilient and how generous the earth is when we really partner with her in a more positive way, in a way that shows that we acknowledge that this is a sacred relationship, that we need to have humility when we're interacting with wild and, you know, natural landscapes.
Amen.
I think you can go a little more mystical there, which is like, we are part of a giant possibility machine. And if you create the conditions that are amenable for a thing to happen, it will happen, right? Absolutely. We just need to stop creating the non-conditions for these things to happen.
Yes.
Love more.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, this has been amazing.
Wait, we got one final question for him. We ask our guests, what are two things in your life that are tickling you right now? And we don't want, something directly related to what we were just talking about. We want something that is recently just making you realize how awesome it is to be alive.
One that I can't resist saying that's like so obvious and in our faces right now are the colors changing. Is just so, you know, I took kids out today at the Montessori school where I teach as a barter for my daughter, and because they want to have permaculture taught there, I took the kids out and we just sat on the edge of this big beaver swamp and just looked out at all the colors for like 20 minutes. I tortured them, made them sit there really quiet.
Can adults go to that school? That sounds like my kind of class.
I haven't had the teachers say that. I wish I were in your class. So that definitely tickled and is tickling me are the colors. The other really is when I get a good rise in my loaf of bread. When it really rises and I get all those nice air pockets, when it has a great crumb, I am really excited about that. Striving to achieve a good crumb and a good fluffy loaf of organic whole wheat flours.
In this house, the equivalent of that is a good turn in the kombucha cycle. When the current brew hits the bullseye, it's like, God is real again. Everything is going to be okay.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. This has been amazing.
Yeah, a real pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And also thank you for changing this house. You changed Joey. So if the goal in life is to leave the world a little better than you came. You already had your effect on this house. So
thank you. Well, I look forward to further collaborations.
Yes, for sure.
Cheers, man.
Be well. Have a good rest of your day.
Oh, he's so great. He really is. Like, he has so much information. Like, it's just level up after. It's like an onion, right? There's just, it doesn't stop.
Well, also, I didn't know that an onion was a leaf. That's a piece of news. But, you know, when he was defining permaculture at the beginning, it's, you know, you could talk about the agriculture part, but he's talking about so much other stuff. It's basically how to do this better.
Yeah. Yep. Use a better model. Right, let's use the earth.
So we just interviewed someone who specializes in how to live better, like in sync with our surroundings as opposed to in opposition to them, which is the goal of it all.
Right? When I first took his course, I remember he was talking, you know, in the beginning about patience and observation. I was like, this is perfect. This is like the lazy girl's guide to gardening. I can just sit around and watch and see how everything happens. It's not really the case, but, you know, it's where you start. You have to start with just a little, just patience and watching everything unfold.
So listeners, Joey took Andrew's course. It just sort of lit her up. For a while, Marguerite and I hated Andrew because he took Joey's Sundays away from us for 12 weeks or something. But it changed her. So if this is something you're at all interested in, check out his site, which he told us there, Joey, permaculturenewyork.com.
Yep.
permaculturenewyork.com. Okay. On the point that you're talking about, patience and listening, I've been dying to use this one. I've got one for you for a while. In a book, Ramesh Balsekar book, he called A Duet of One, he was talking about, he said the word intelligence comes from inter and legcre, L-E-G-C-R-E, which means to reach between.
Mm.
Now, like the dictionary will just tell you intelligence is something like mental alertness. But if you go back to the reach between thing, listening intelligently means reading between the lines with alertness without letting your own thinking come in over top of the listening itself. Right. Or letting conceptualizing, you know, if someone's talking to you and you divert your mind and be like, oh, I know what they're talking about, and start thinking about the thing that you think is relevant to what they're talking about, you are no longer listening.
Right.
And Balsekar was referring to Indian sage, another Indian sage, Krishnamurti, who said the ability to observe without evaluating is the highest form of intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
We're so used to the instinct, which is, oh, I already know that. That when that kicks in, you have stopped listening to the person. At least you have stopped listening intelligently. And the goal of a lot of yoga is to quiet the mind so that you can receive the message from the cosmos without climbing all over it and dressing it up in your own ideas before it's even been made clear to you. And one of the things that's happened to me in the last couple of years is like, I had a moment where I told you everything I thought I knew was wrong. I realized that I'd been, and like most people, spent a lot of time thinking about what I knew and not enough time being open to the things that I didn't know. And one way you can achieve that is by listening intelligently.
That's what Eckhart Tolle says. Anytime that you think you know something, it's a sign that your ego is running the show versus just your being, right? When you're in a state of pure being and pure awareness, you are just purely observing, which is that's where that highest form of intelligence is. It's like he talks about that the Buddha gave a sermon once and the entire sermon was him just holding up a flower.
But let's be clear about this. It doesn't mean that you're not doing something just as some kind of passive witness. It means that your consciousness has disconnected from the part that is the doing and is residing up at a higher level.
Yes.
And watching what is happening.
Yep. Not that you're checked out, spaced out, that you're actually more in tune and more acutely focused on what is happening, but without the mental overlay.
All right. So on that note, we're going to finish with a mind bender. This is one of these ones, people, that Joey tries to advise me not to do because, well, for the obvious reasons. Ramesh Balsekar is one of my favorite thinkers ever. And I have gone back to, in the last few years, for the very first time in my life, I've gone back to several books I've recently read and read them again. And it happens with Sri Aurobindo, but it also happens with Ramesh Balsekar. I've read several of his books twice and a few of them multiple times. And this is only in the last 3 years. So anyway, he was talking in this book about, he's like, what do we want as seekers, right? If you're spiritually seeking or think you're spiritually seeking, like if you want to find the meaning of it all, right? And the answer is you want to find God, or another way you could talk about that is you want immortality, or you want the infinite. And as he points out, as my friend Dave Foster said to me once, don't tell me the seeker is the sought. If you tell me the seeker is the sought, I'm going to explode. But what Balsekar says is the joke is that that is what we already are, the thing that we're seeking, the infinite and the immortal. And here's how he explains it. It's pretty good. It is a truism that what is perceived cannot be what is perceiving. We can perceive our bodies, and therefore the perceiving we must necessarily be outside or beyond our bodies. Here's where it gets good. Perceiving from a dimension outside the three dimensions constituting the volume of our bodies. What he means there is we inhabit our body, but because you can perceive your body, you are seeing it from somewhere else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's got to be outside the three dimensions, right? And he says, the perceiving we is perceiving everywhere all the time, and therefore must be a dimensional element not available to our sensorial apparatus. This extra dimension is beyond space-time. So if you can see yourself from in three dimensions, you're seeing it from outside those three dimensions. And also what he's saying is the fact that you are always perceiving.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, your perception is not based on time, right? It's not at this moment you were perceiving and at this moment you weren't. So your perception is both outside space, the three dimensions, and also outside time. So if it's outside space, right, the three dimensions of the volume of your bodies, then it is in a formless place.
Mm-hmm.
And if it is outside time, it is timeless. So the part of you that can observe yourself exists both not in space and not in time. And therefore, if something is not bound by space, it is infinite. If something is not bound by time, it is eternal. Therefore, you are infinite and eternal. And it's just fairly logical, right? It's the fact that you can observe yourself and that you can observe from beyond the three dimensions and also at all times. Mm-hmm. You are infinite and eternal. You are God. You are immortal. You are the infinite.
Very nice.
That's the joke.
You broke it down.
Dave Foster, if you're listening, the seeker is the sought. We are looking for the infinite and we are the infinite. So, and Bhaskar says, when this is apprehended, that the seeker himself is precisely what he is seeking, the seeking ceases, and along with it, all questions and problems. There you go.
Bang,
and then, and from that, yeah, bang, done. From there, you just carry on. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with you next week.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to How to Tickle Yourself with your host, Duff McDonald, and me, Joey of Rockledge. You can help us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. You can talk to us and see what else is happening on Instagram and Facebook at How to Tickle Yourself. This program was recorded in Studio B of the historic Rockledge Recording Studio. Right here, right now, our original 16-part theme music was written and recorded by the legendary Paul Reddick and Kyle Ferguson of the Sidemen, with Steve Mariner on bass and drums and in the mixing room. This podcast is produced and distributed by Storic Media. Our editor is Oscar Desiderio. Our producers are Kristen Verbitsky and Chuck LaBella. For more information, visit storicmedia.com. That's storicmedia.com.